You can now listen to Conning the Con ad-free on Apple subscription and buymeacoffee.com/Conning the Con. But that is not all you will find there. I've got two little words for you. Tonka Trilogy. If you know, you know, right? And if you don't, keep listening to Conning the Con and it will all become clear soon enough. And if you want a sneak peek, head over to @ConningTheCon on Instagram and get a look at the lighter side of this, well, very heavy con story. Simply click the subscribe button now on Apple Podcasts for ad-free and bonus content. Or if you aren't an Apple user, head to buymeacoffee.com/ConningTheCon, where on top of that ad-free and bonus content, you can access exclusive videos. You'll find all the links, as always, in the show notes. Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal, because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today. Hello, my tribe of true crime addicts. It's Sarah from Conning the Con podcast here. And I imagine you and I have quite a bit in common. I am a complete true crime podcast junkie. And having had the opportunity to go to CrimeCon 2021 and meet all my fellow podcasters on Podcast Row, well, I was like a kid in a candy store. Not to mention all of the incredible speakers, exhibitors, authors that were also spilling the tea there all weekend long. So don't miss out on the next CrimeCon. It's in June on the 11th and 12th in London 2022. Trust me, you don't want FOMO. Don't forget to use the code CTHEC at checkout to get your exclusive Conning the Con discount. That's CTHEC. You know, like Conning the Con. I can't wait to meet you all there. Hi, listeners. This is episode 11 of 14. This episode touches on recovery from trauma, dealing with stressful moments, and how to find calm. But it is just the tip of the iceberg. For more insightful tips and tools, check out the amazing Dr. Muir and her wealth of knowledge. She's got it all at drsophiemuir.com. And we are forever grateful for her wisdom throughout Conning the Con. And what you may not know is that prior to being conned, my little sister Emma was already a stress and breathing coach and so had more tools in the toolbox at the ready when the Tonks trauma tornado hit. For years, Emma has been sharing her wisdom online with her business, thebreatheffect.com, where she teaches men and women around the globe how to reset after trauma, stress, and life's big moments. And thankfully, dating a con man is not a prerequisite to benefiting from her tools. Her background as a physiotherapist, breathing and stress coach have created a unique process for men and women to learn how to rewire their brain and reset their nervous system following trauma. So if you're ready to reset your relationship with stress and move from survival mode to thrive, then check out one of her life-changing online courses and retreats. Head over to thebreatheffect.com. It really is jam-packed with free resources to get you started. As always, the links are in the show notes. And finally, don't forget to head over to our Instagram and Facebook pages to get involved in the conversations over there. And of course, get a sneak peek at what's coming up on Wednesdays when we drop the trailers. Something is creeping in. Don't follow it down. You know, know, life takes on some really interesting twists and turns, and sometimes you find yourself stopping and asking how you found yourself where you are today, like right now. Like, how the heck did Emma and I end up making a podcast about a serial con man? If you'd told 2018 Sarah or 2018 Emma that that's what our 2020 selves would be doing amidst a worldwide pandemic, well, I think we would have laughed you out of the room. Since the start of the project, though, Emma has always been really laser-focused on the two reasons she wanted to share her very raw and very personal story. The first was to educate others so that they can protect themselves from falling victim to the world's complete oversupply of fraudsters. And the second is to share how to recover from trauma. And that's where we've arrived right now with this episode. We're going to share a conversation with Dr. Sophie Muir about how to manage stress and recover from trauma.
This isn't just about people being conned here. This is about anybody that goes through life's traumatic events.
I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris. And this is my story, Conning the Con. The shadow dark upon the wall, moving slow and stretching tall, and her hands hold a mug that's cold. The shadow dark upon the wall, moving slow and stretching tall, and out to the mountains her gaze is pulled.
In today's episode, we're going to share a conversation with Dr. Muir. And it's about how to recover from stress and trauma. This is a big part of what I teach, and I wanted to have Sophie's input and get people to realize there's things that we can do to get our lives back in control and back on track after experiencing something like this or any big life change that you go through. So my background is a physio, and it seems weird that I've moved into this world of breathing coaching and stress management, but it's this natural progression for me in the fact that our body holds so much tension and stress. And while we often look at the top 2 inches about it, I realize a big part of it is about the body. And so in today's episode, Sophie and I will be exploring what you can do, maybe a bit about what I did to help get myself back on track. And I hope it inspires you if you are feeling like you need help to reach out for it.
As a starting point for that conversation, we're going to share parts of Emma's victim impact statement, the purpose of which is to give the victim of crime the opportunity to have their say in court. It marks one of the first steps along the roadmap to recovery. And for Emma, it's the first moment to be heard and start to take back the power.
I met the defendant in October 2018 when he went on Tinder dating app. From the day we met, he lied. He lied about his name, his businesses, his family, his history. I've always been a very trusting person before I met him, and he preyed on my kind, empathetic, vulnerable nature and used it to build trust with him so he could achieve his con. I never thought humans were capable of such an in-depth lie, especially when they work their way into your life and family. At points along the way, I remember saying to myself, but why would anyone ever lie about all the things he is saying? I dated him for just over 5 months, and while I know people have said to me, why did you give him money when you didn't know him for that long? I had treated it as a business arrangement. He'd shown me documents that I found out later were falsified, and that he said he had enough funds to pay me back whenever I wanted. Andrew deliberately set out to build trust. Not just through words, it was the actions that added to the layers of deceit. In hindsight, I recognise he set out on Tinder with criminal intent, and every action, date, and text from him was calculated, and a layer in the fake life he had made me believe we were building together. He'd worked his way into my life, met my extended family over Christmas holidays, and in February he had met my kids. This was a huge step for me, and I only wanted to introduce them to good people that I planned to have around. My kids thought he was fun and engaging and would ask when he was coming to visit. My heart broke again when I realized he had involved children in his con, all for just money. This is not a man who accidentally falls upon an opportunity to exploit someone on Tinder. All his moves have been calculated and premeditated. Andrew brought my trust by bringing his mother over to visit, and she even stayed at my home for 3 nights and met my kids. Never over that time did he leave me alone with her so I could have a conversation with her, and she never told me that he'd been in jail before for fraud. Who doesn't tell a woman who is single with 2 kids that she is dating a man with a criminal record? If it wasn't for my good friends that realized what he was saying didn't add up and digging so much deeper than I had, they found out who he really was. On the 8th of April, my life fell apart. What I had no idea was how bloody hard, scary, and isolating the next 3 months would be. Well, I had to keep up the charade with the defendant, and that one day I might possibly want a relationship with him, all to be able to get as much of the money back as possible, trying to minimize that financial loss I had sustained from him. The minute I found out who he was, I worked with my bank and my brother to freeze the funds. This was the hardest day of my life. I knew that if I didn't step up that day, then I would lose all my money. And at 36 with 2 kids, I didn't know if I could recover from that. I had to play the victim to get Andrew to show up and transfer that money back to me. In the bank, Andrew tried to pretend to be nice, but his mask slipped and showed how angry he was. He threatened me that he could have my kids taken away from me for lying, which at the moment was rather ironic coming from him. He also threatened he would hurt my brother in Christchurch and that he knew people that could hurt people. I had to keep calm and get through that moment. I knew there were cameras on me and he couldn't hurt me at that time, and I needed to get my money back. This was only day one of the next 3 months of torture until Andrew was arrested. For the first 2 weeks after Andrew's identity was revealed, I feared for my safety and my kids. I had no idea who I was dealing with and what he was capable of. It wasn't until Andrew fled to Australia and the detective informed me that he had left that I could relax just a little for our safety. Each day until his arrest was awful. He would send text messages that were lies, manipulations, and emotional torture. I'd been advised that if I was going to get any money back and get justice, I had to go and do what I could to keep up the communication. And this was hell. Many times I broke down. I still don't know how I got through those times and showed up to work as a physio, running my business and pretending all was okay, when really my life was falling apart. I had to work half a day at a time to survive. I went and had counseling to help keep me together and process the emotional abuse I'd sustained, but I was very much in it, and I know it would take me years to rebuild from the emotional scars he's caused. As the months went along, I learned about the other people that he'd been conning along the way, and that I was only a small piece of the puzzle, and they'd hurt many other people. The current financial cost to me with the money that he owes me is $98,000. This is a huge burden and a loss to carry. I also know that he could have stolen $300,000, and I'm lucky to not be in more debt because of him. When I finally got the call that Andrew had been arrested, I dropped to the ground. I cried, laughed, and screamed, and my body shook, finally letting go of the trauma that I had been holding on to. I wish I had been smarter than that. But I also know the emotional manipulation lies trust he'd worked to build helped him position himself to take advantage of me and my family. I feel sick thinking about what he did, and I'm often paralyzed with the thought of letting someone else into my life again. After what he has done, I'm not sure how I rebuild trust in someone. And that has left me feeling very isolated, lonely, and sad over the past few months since I found out who Andrew really is. I'm not sure I will ever get over what he's done. And he's made me a very different person because of it. My trust in men is very broken. And I continue to be on edge when a man wants to get close, never knowing what is true and what is a lie. This is an awful place to be. Knowing that someone chose me as their mark and worked for months to gain my trust, more than just a business transaction, haunt me. He used my vulnerabilities, my empathy, and dreams to manipulate my life. I will eventually get over what he did to me, and hopefully one day I can learn to trust in time. But I will never, ever get over the fact that he involved my children and scarred their view of the world. There's a true psychopath that could do that. I've covered a lot of the emotional harm Andrew caused me throughout my whole statement. I've truly struggled to write all this, as there is so much pain. While I don't have any physical signs of abuse, the mental and emotional scars run so deep. My view of the world has forever changed by this one man's selfish actions. I am still scared that he could hurt me, that he will continue to hurt others, and this will forever haunt me for years to come. I want to finish by saying, Andrew, you have caused so much pain and destruction in your life. There is no part of me that believes you could be rehabilitated and do good in the world. I hope for the sake of your future possible victims, you stop today.
Well, that was probably one of the hardest pieces of the podcast to listen to when I was editing. I mean, that is my little sister and I feel her pain so acutely. But how was it for her to reread those words now?
Even though it's months and months after and I still feel like I'm in a really good space, I think when you reflect and read the words that meant so much to me, it does bring stuff up. It's also an okay thing that it brings so much up because those are the scars that are there. You know, looking back over it, just reminding me of why I chose to fight back. I had a flashback to standing in the court. Man, I felt like a lioness, just so strong and fierce. And I'm just so glad I had that moment and I did step up and do it. But I know people will hear it and they'll be thinking, oh, you're so broken. I'm like, but we all go through grief and trauma and it's just the way that you learn to move it through it. And I guess it's something that I've learned with this idea of grief. When grief comes up, it's like, you know, it can be like a shaped like a box. And this analogy works for me is that box can then over time, you build your life around that box and you move on and you know, the box gets smaller. And then sometimes something will come up and whether it's the fact that he was released and that grief comes back up and it hits you like a wave that you have to ride, then the grief box will go smaller and you build your life and you grow around it. And part of this experience is about me developing the tools and the knowledge and the awareness how to move through that. It's a really weird healing journey.
What would you say to someone who had been a victim of crime and they had the opportunity to do a victim impact statement and they were on the fence about it?
Oh, such a hard one, because I think one big part of that is feeling like you're supported and nurtured before you go in there, that you've got your person beside you that can help you get through. One thing is you don't actually have to read it out in court. For me, that was super powerful. So I don't think he even, you know, heard me saying the words and or believed it, you know. It was just like deflected off him. But it wasn't about the defendant, the con man. That moment of stepping up was all about me. And as much as I look at this whole process, it's about regaining power, regaining control and trust. And a big part was trust in myself. It didn't mean that it wasn't really hard and I used all my breathing techniques to get through that day and that I didn't feel, you know, exhausted emotionally because I stepped up. But what I felt for me was that bravery was the only option. Bravery to step up and tell my side.
And how did you feel once you'd done it after all of that initial trepidation?
So much relief. I think this feeling of weight going off me, not because of doing it, but because I had my moment. That victim impact statement is just one slice of this whole experience, but it was an important one. People had read the victim impact statement, like the judge and the detective and even the con man, Andrew, before I went in there. So they visually looked at it. But yeah, to be heard in that sense, it is important. I think the biggest bit for me was the judge's words. He said there was nothing that I did to warrant this, to deserve what this man did. That sticks with me as being a victim. And you go, did I bring this on myself? Like where along the way have I failed? And I felt that failure through this whole process, judgment from family, from friends, even putting this podcast out there, that comes with judgment. But I've got to a point where I don't really care about those opinions because what's really important, what's always driven me forward is this quest to be heard in the right way so that others learn. It's the only reason we're doing this, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's probably a good time to say thanks to all those listeners who have reached out and shared the positive impact that Emma's story has had on processing their own experiences. But now it's time to pick up on the conversation we had with Dr. Muir, starting with a question looking at that victim impact statement from the other side of the coin. Would someone high in psychopathy actually be capable of recognizing the impact that they've had on a victim?
Yeah, that's exceptionally hard to say as a rule. But I mean, we do know that that empathy switch is generally turned off. And sometimes they know how to cognitively understand the harm that was caused, but doesn't necessarily mean they're going to feel genuine remorse for it. The other thing is it's hard to tease out what is remorse versus what is like shame, embarrassment, regret, feeling upset about the effects on their own life. You know, those can look quite similar in terms of the body language of feeling ashamed and embarrassed for oneself versus actually being upset for the other person.
I think that's a very key point. So the other part of that was at the end of the sentencing, the detective who I'd been working with that whole time was amazing. He gave me a letter that was from Andrew, but it's like a 4-page, I'm so sorry for everything. And I guess my question about that is, as you know, again, that genuineness of it. Like, I remember getting it and being like, this feels like another manipulation.
Yeah, I think the things you'd be looking at is like, what is the depth of language that's used? Is it a lot of superficial, generic statements? Or are they actually able to identify and specify like what the impact is on you? Like how much of it also is about, again, them like feeling regret versus actually focusing on the impact it's had on you? I can't comment in the case of Andrew, but like what was your sense of reading that letter?
Absolute bullshit, basically. And along with that, I'm promised to pay everything back again. Like I'll do everything I can. And then the next few weeks away, then going and getting the money reduced that he has to pay back for the sentence. He was still trying to get his way back in to be like, I can explain to you why I got to this point. And, you know, if you give me that sort of chance, it's like, God, no, God, no. It's very empty and very superficial with it and not really anything going into the actual impact.
People who are quite manipulative and high in psychopathy, they do want to be seen in a positive light. They do care about their facade, like it's all this impression management. Sending a letter maintains a sense that I'm a good person, look at me doing the right thing. So it could be serving a function like that.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine, from history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts, and on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing. I'm Sarah Ferris. Join me and my co-host, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program, Catherine Schweit.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've watched the reality of poor planning. I've traced heroic acts of bravery, and I've really sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Our hope is that together we can stop the cries of never again fading into until next time.
Okay, so it's Sunday, January
19th.
For nearly a year, my friend Aria dated men she met online. Lots of duds, disappointments, and some disasters. But then along came Mordecai, and Aria fell hard.
I opened the door. There's a woman standing there, and she said, "I think you know someone named Mordecai Horowitz." And I said, "Oh, you better come in."
In 2019, a friend of mine fell for a sensitive millionaire named Mordecai. And then she found out she wasn't the only one. It was way too good to be true. I'm Kathleen Goldhar, the host of Do You Know Mordecai from USG Audio. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
The other questions I had was about this process of stepping up and reading your victim impact statement. So what does that process of doing a victim impact statement or not doing it impact maybe the psychology of somebody?
Yeah, I suppose from like a trauma framework, if you think about when someone experiences a trauma, there's that real sense of powerlessness and you're often at the time really blocked from carrying out the actions that you want to. You're in fight or flight mode, but you can't actually act on that. So you're really stuck in that freeze. Going into court and being able to stand up and speak to the effects that the trauma has on you, it could help to carry out that blocked response to regain some sense of power or strength. But it's still quite an individual thing. Like, how did you find it?
It was such a strong process to go through. First time I went to court and I saw his face in November the year previously, I remember just being like shaking and being angry in that seat. And it was like, it was good. I could feel like it finally coming out. So I'm sure everybody will experience it differently. And then I realized I didn't have anybody around me actually at that time of court because the detective was supposed to be coming that day. And I still actually, I feel myself now feeling really unsupported in that moment. But that was also because I didn't think I could step up and get that support from people around me. Like to be like, you know what, I'm just going to court. I'm just going to be in that room. Why do I need it? But I think it actually, you don't realize how much that impact has. And you kind of go, like, I'm strong, I'll get through it, and it's fine. I'm just going to go to court and listen. And it was like, I was so angry. I wanted to shout at the judge and be like, he is lying. And so then when I went back for that main sentencing, I did prepare myself, and I had like my solid rock woman beside me, and then the detective was there as well, which was really useful. I feel my body tensing up and just this process of going like, no, I'm gonna get through this, and I'm going to say those words. And then sitting in the court waiting, it was weird because Sasha's quite a wonderful person, but I could feel like even though she was sitting beside me, I felt like she had her arms around me virtually, like this little wee security bubble. So I sat there and I felt really, really strong having her there. He comes in, this feeling of just like, I actually think I've had a lot of anger coming up at that time. And that drove me to feel really comfortable and confident and strong when I got up there and said my words. For that journey through the court, is there anything that as someone that's going through that could do to prepare and survive that process better?
Well, you described some really key things that you were able to do in terms of having a support person there. It's super important to have someone around you who makes you feel safe and kind of in control. And then being familiarized exactly with what to expect, you know, who's going to be there. Where will you sit? Where will they be? What are you going to say? What might they be saying? Maybe having like a grounding tool, because when you see someone who's offended against you, you can feel the return of that high level of distress, intense distress. You feel like you're back at the time where you were victimized. So having a tool at hand to actually ground yourself into the present moment, to know that you're safe, to know that you can't be harmed in that moment is really important. And then if there are ways beforehand to gradually start exposing yourself to reminders and cues of them in preparation, because it'll just reduce that flooding. If you've kind of been avoiding all memories and thoughts of that person, then suddenly you're just confronted with them. It's quite a dramatic change. So if there is any way to kind of gradually begin to expose yourself to reminders. But sometimes, you know, that's something that you might need, depending on the level of trauma and your response to it, you might need some psychological support to kind of guide you through that exposure process.
That definitely helped me a lot with that preparation, was actually tuning into my body and how it was reacting. So doing all the trauma release exercises. I hate to say it, it's so cheesy, but the breathing did really help, like getting through, like being able to be aware when I was being triggered and when something would come up and then try and regulate it, because it was just this kind of like internal overwhelming taking over of it, like hijacking of my system. So I had to keep coming back. And while it was the psychology piece, my body was really the bit that was reacting so strongly. And didn't realize that it was like I had to keep changing that, and then the brain would kind of settle down and be like, okay, you're safe, because that's really what it is. Like when you see that person, you feel unsafe and you feel like you are under attack, even just visually or thinking about it, even though that he's not there in that moment. One of the questions I think is this idea of trusting again, and how do you move forward with? How do I move forward with that?
Yeah, after you've been betrayed or traumatized, your threat detector system is likely to be quite out of whack after that. And like it can obviously overcorrect. So you'll find yourself becoming very hypervigilant to threat. You'll experience a lot of anxiety in new relationships. You come to kind of mistrust yourself almost. It is important to get some assistance or tools to recalibrate that. And part of it is, like you've talked about, knowing how to soothe your physical stress reaction when the alarm bells do go off. So once you can calm yourself down a little bit, then you can be in a better position to be able to like weigh up the actual evidence that's in front of you. Like, is there actually evidence of someone being mistrustful versus what is the evidence that you can trust this person? And getting that balance right is quite hard, and it's really good to check in with people around you around their impressions if you're starting to move forward and build new relationships. But I guess overall it is recognizing that trust is still like an adaptive human function. Like we need to trust others to, you know, to work in cohesive groups, to live in a healthy way. You can't obviously isolate yourself forever. So recognizing that trust is still a good thing, and maybe contextualizing things that these people who have betrayed your trust are typically not the norm. This is a minority. But I guess, yeah, it's important, I think, as well, to develop some kind of strategy going forward around like what your boundaries will be, knowing what your red flags and warning signs are. How will you get support from others if your smoke detectors are going off? You're not sure if someone's trustworthy.
I love that idea of smoke detectors. That gut instinct is still one of the biggest keys. But one of the things I think I've learned along the way is that's only going to occur when I take space and time for me to actually check in. My life was so full and busy that I wasn't actually putting myself first. And so I wasn't taking time out to actually tune in and listen. And that feels like that's been a really strong practice now, whether it's mindfulness or whatever you do. Like I've got to have days, there's days that I have my grief days. They haven't been as much recently, but those grief days, when they come on, they're sometimes like a Sunday, and it's really annoying because it's the day you finally let go and you're like, yay, I can chill out. And then you're like, oh no, oh damn it, here it comes. And I've got to sit with it. And I just feel like coming on now talking about it. And it's so uncomfortable, that process. And it's not like, it doesn't just end, does it? Doesn't it suddenly stop?
No, it doesn't. It is something that will become maybe less intense or less frequent, but like you say, will come up. And it's super important to make room for those feelings and show yourself that you are strong and you can actually hold those feelings and you will get through them. They're like a wave, you know, they will have a crest, but they will fall. They do have a natural lifespan if you make some room for them.
You know, I look at it and I go, well, how do most people get through traumatic experiences like this? I see people years later that have had something from 20, 30 years ago that they haven't processed.
It also depends on like the extent of the trauma, how chronic it has been in someone's life. If it's something that's been pervasive from an early age within a multitude of relationships, it is going to take a really, really long time to get through. And you can't necessarily stop some of the reactions that will come up or being triggered or being mistrusting, but you can learn the skills to regulate it once it does come up.
How do we be supportive in a way that is going to nurture someone through this?
I think when someone has been victimized by a trauma, it's really helpful to have some support there that's just reliable, predictable, and calm, because of the whole whirlwind and chaos of trauma and how that's impacted you. Like, what you need is just something that's a stable base. So anything people can do just to be predictable, and also just being a container for someone's emotions, like validating it's okay to feel them, letting them cry, staying calm, being that kind of physical presence, and then avoiding things like questioning or blame, because obviously someone experiences a trauma, there's so much shame, you know, and embarrassment, and people do blame themselves. So having someone who can reflect that you're not at fault, that's really helpful.
Because you can't take the pain away. You can't fix it for people.
Yeah, definitely people want to problem solve. And like you say, that's not what you want in that moment. You don't want to learn how you could have done something different, or like what could have been, because how is that going to help at that point? It's happened.
Is there anything with recovery from trauma that people can do that we know are like the go-tos for that?
In terms of timeline, it's difficult to put a number on it, because trauma does present so differently for different people, and they've had that really developmental trauma, something that's happened early in life and has been chronic, that's going to require like a long-term therapeutic intervention. And, you know, because if someone's never had any reliable, trusting relationships, they've kind of got to build from the bottom up with that. And the therapeutic relationship often becomes that. So actually having a therapist be present, be reliable, be calm, and listen to you and work with you for a year or a number of years, it actually teaches you what trust is within that relationship. And in terms of, like, I suppose the different phases of trauma recovery, like the first would be really getting to know and understand your body and your physical reaction to trauma, like you've talked about, those mindfulness skills to observe your reactions, knowing that emotions have this lifespan like a wave, knowing how changing your posture, your breathing, all those things can reduce your response. Because when people go through something like this, often what they come to fear is actually their own body, like their own reaction to triggers, not even, you know, it can become removed a little bit from the perpetrator and actually just be this fear of yourself. And then it would be processing traumatic memories. And sometimes that does mean going back through and revisiting the memories, talking about things in like a kind of chronological narrative around it. There are really effective therapies like EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is one of the most effective therapies for treating traumatic memories, reducing the distress that's actually associated with remembering. And that's something that a therapist can do. And then like gradual exposure to cues and triggers, because when people go through this, they often start to withdraw and avoid any reminders. And then the world becomes really small. So kind of starting to get back out there, re-engage in life, re-engage with people and activities and places that make you feel calm and safe and strong, and making space for joy. And then I think establishing some new boundaries going forward around who are you going to let into life, what are your non-negotiables, and that sort of thing, coming up with a plan. You know, part of the difficulty with trauma is how your brain is processed those memories. And when you're having a traumatic reaction, certain parts of the brain are offline. So the kind of rational thinking parts, different memory centers that actually like process and store something as having happened in the past in this kind of chronological coherent narrative that you need to actually just like file it in the back and then move forward with life. That kind of doesn't happen when you go through a trauma. So EMDR creates that chronological narrative of the memory, but it also does so while you activate the regions of the brain that need to be activated to process something. So one way of doing it is while you remember distressing parts of the trauma, you'll observe your therapist, they'll be moving their hand from side to side, kind of like a hypnotherapist, but what they're doing is they're getting your eyes to move, and that activates the regions of the brain that you need to process the memory. And it's amazing, like it really hugely reduces distress associated with that memory. It's such a powerful tool. I've done it with people, and like the amazement, people are often very skeptical about it because it sounds like hypnotherapy, which it's not. So they go into it with a healthy level of skepticism, but watching their reaction when the distress reduces, it's really amazing.
Similar things when I'm doing trauma release exercises in the body with the shaking. And working with that, that's been one of my big go-tos because I can bring on the shake quite quickly when I think about a con man. And I can make my body do it now, and it's great. It's a nice way of actually letting that release. But then if I think about the kids, I'm like, it's gone. I can just, it just goes because they don't make me feel that response. So I can desensitize it, and it just gets rid of that adrenaline and that tension that gets stored in the body. One of the things I wanted to bring up was that he will be released one day. How do people deal with the fact that that release might come, though?
If you do have genuine fear around your safety, putting mechanisms in place to actually keep yourself safe. But part of the difficulty too is that people can start to really withdraw from life and avoid a lot of places and activities that they think they might see that person. It can be quite a downward spiral if there isn't actually any physical safety threat anymore. So as much as possible, trying to keep engaging in life and not giving in to the avoidance, to demonstrate to yourself that you are safe, you can cope. That is obviously an extremely challenging thing to do. So professional support with that if you need as well.
That fear is not something that I like to sit in because that just feels yucky and I've already been in that for a long time. So I choose not to.
Yeah, with recovery, I think one of the big things that people can find helpful is like thinking of it in terms of values. So how do I want to show up for myself in this life? Do I want to protect myself and avoid all risks, but in doing so, not form deeper connections? Or do I want to actually live openly with vulnerability, knowing that yes, that can bring risk, but it also, like, love and connection are too important for me to give up. So I guess it's like taking that level of risk can be easier when you see that the upside is that you've committed to this like brave, courageous, open life, because what is the alternative to that?
So I guess the last thing is, can leopards change their spots, Sophie? Can con men ever change and do good in the world?
I mean, they can change their behavior, right? So they can learn to regulate their urges or their antisocial thoughts and actually change behavior, but you're not going to see a change in underlying personality structure for someone who's high in psychopathy and has really entrenched antisocial beliefs and values. And it's going to be very hard to change the underlying personality structure. It's not a very nice ending, but it's that is reality.
I have learned so much from having Dr. Sophie as part of this podcast, and our conversations have helped highlight to me how much it wasn't my fault, what this person did and his intentions was for his own gains, and that I was this target, and there are things that I will always do differently from this experience. I wish I didn't have to have this experience to know that. So the big ones for me are boundaries, absolutely, with boundaries and listening to my gut. That's probably the most important one. And it's actually served me so well in the last few months as I have been recovering from this. It's just become really clear of how important that gut is. And it's what I teach about. It's what I speak about. And the more that I practice that, the clearer I feel about what went wrong over that time. And so I don't blame myself. I have forgiven myself for making those errors of judgment, because this person, yeah, he went out and intentionally targeted me. It's really hard to explain as well how hurtful and the psychological damage somebody can cause from that. So I know that I will still have to repair for a long time. And as we talked about trust and rebuilding, there is so many layers to that. But if I can take anything away from what Sophie has shared with all of you and with Sarah and I, it's that listening to the gut and the boundaries in place are crucial. It doesn't mean you don't let somebody in. And I will forever be careful of putting a wall up, because my life is not going to be in a tower now where I don't have these connections and relationships. That is not what this has taught me. This is about bringing the right people into my life and serving those connections and those relationships. So, you know, in some ways, I thank Sophie for those lessons. I'm not sure if I'm ready to thank Andrew for those lessons, because he doesn't deserve anything from me. But I know this experience has taught me so much about what's okay and what's not okay in my life. And I wish I'd known them in my 20s. I wish I'd known them in my 30s. And now as I move into the next 40s decade of my life, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be unstoppable.
The shadow dark upon the wall, moving slow and stretching tall, and her hands hold a mug that's cold. The shadow dark upon the wall, moving slow and stretching tall, and up to the mountains her gaze is pulled.
If you liked our story, please share with family and friends. And like, subscribe, and review so others can learn from my lessons. If you or anyone you know has been affected by something similar, please reach out for help. You are not alone. We've included some links in our show notes. Conning the Con was made with the input of Dr. Sophie Muir, and the original music is by the talented Aroha Min.
Something is creeping in, don't follow it down.
Hello, and welcome to Guilty Greenie. I feel like we should start off this show by saying it's nearly impossible to be 100% sustainable given the current world we live in.
How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Not a great analogy for a vegetarian, but, you know.
We're talking about sustainability, maybe not the best analogy.
Don't eat the elephant is the first rule of the Guilty Greenie.
There's your first challenge of the week. Avoid elephants. What they used to call frugal is now considered sustainable.
That's such an aha moment. Frugal to sustainable.
You can save money and help the planet. That's going to be our new
tagline for sure.
Yeah, you can find Guilty Greenie on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And join us in tackling the Guilty Greenie challenges. Until then, stay curiously green.
Something is creeping in.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy, and you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
That was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, the long con. That's Clueless, spelt K-L-O-O-G-H-L-E-S-S.
Hi, this is Amy and Vanessa from She Goes By Jane, where we shine light on the stories of missing and unidentified women. On November 7th, we're sharing Nahida's story for the first time in a podcast. And this is a story that I thought I knew, but after reading police reports, became more complicated than I thought. When investigators are called to Nahida Khatib's house, everything looks fine. Her purse is on the kitchen table, her cup of coffee is on the counter, and her two-year-old niece is in her playpen. The only thing amiss? Nahida is missing.
Every week, we feature a poem written in honor of the person we're talking about. This week, we're joined by one of our favorite actresses. You might know her from Sister Act or King of the Hill or The Descendants. But if you're like us, you'll know her from Hocus Pocus. She's the much beloved Kathy Najimy. Join us November 7th to hear Nahida's story.